Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we take the vast, chaotic world of information and, well, trying to distill it down into the core knowledge you need.
Glad to be back.
And today, we are diving deep into a figure who is just synonymous with beautiful, sprawling, and let's be honest, often disastrous cinematic ambition.
Oh, that's putting it mildly. He's a true architect of the surreal.
Terry Hugh Gilliam.
A visual revolutionary. I mean, his entire career is about pitting this boundless individual imagination against rigid, oppressive bureaucracy.
Absolutely. He embodies this creative chaos that, you know, very few filmmakers ever dare to touch, let alone survive.
And survive he does.
Exactly. And what makes him so unique and so central to these themes of displacement and identity that just run through all his films is that dual heritage.
Right. The American-British thing.
Yeah. He was born Terrence Vance Gilliam in Minneapolis, Minnesota, but he is, for all intents and purposes, a British cultural institution.
He got his British citizenship way, way back in 1968.
And then, in this highly public and, I mean, very Gilliam-esque protest, he formally renounced his American citizenship in 2006.
It's the perfect narrative setup for his entire career, isn't it? A perpetual outsider who deliberately chooses his identity.
It feeds directly into his major thematic work. The individual fighting the system.
Absolutely. So our mission today is really to unpack this incredible trajectory. We're going to trace his path from, you know, a stack of old Victorian photos and some cutouts.
The things that defined the entire visual language of Monty Python.
All the way to his emergence as the director of some of the most critically praised and visually dense dystopian films of the late 20th century.
So we're looking at Gilliam not just as a director or an animator.
No, you can't.
He's a screenwriter, a comedian, often a very reluctant actor. And all these disparate roles are linked by these consistent, recognizable themes.
And we have to understand, the man who, now in his mid-80s, remains just fiercely creative and, as we'll get into, increasingly provocative.
His core identity as a filmmaker is defined by that blend of genres, right? Black comedy and tragic comedy.
Always. And it's always exploring that struggle between an individual's flight of fancy and this suffocating authoritarian state control.
Invariably set these rich, crumbling, utterly dense dystopian worlds. You can almost feel the texture of his films.
Oh, the dust, the noise, the clutter. It's always there. It's a character in itself.
And he has the accolades to back up a lifetime of these visual and creative battles. I think we should mention up front, he got the BAFTA Award for Outstanding British Contribution to Cinema in 88.
And then the ultimate honor, the BAFTA Fellowship for Lifetime Achievement in 2009.
He is a cultural titan who literally built his empire on glue, scissors, and a complete refusal to compromise. Okay, so let's unpack this first stage. How does a kid from Minnesota end up not just joining, but fundamentally defining the visual language of, I mean, the most influential British comedy troupe of all time?
It's an amazing story, and you have to start with his surprisingly conventional American roots.
Right, it's not what you'd expect.
Not at all. It's a classic American story, really. Migration, intellectual curiosity, and satire. He was born in Minneapolis in 1940. The family moved around Minnesota a bit, but the big shift came when he was 12.
They moved to California.
To California, yes. Specifically Panorama City, Los Angeles, in 1952.
And his father was a traveling salesman, I believe, for Folgers Coffee.
That's right. Before shifting careers to become a carpenter, it seems like a relatively conventional, you know, middle-class background.
But the seeds of that lifelong anti-establishment surrealist viewpoint, they were planted early and very decisively.
We know exactly where those seeds came from.
Mad Magazine.
Mad Magazine. During high school, he became an absolutely avid reader. And crucially, this was during its golden age, when it was edited by Harvey Kurtzman.
Gilliam himself has said it, right, unequivocally.
He has. He said that Mad Comics and their particular brand of visual absurd satire inspired everything they later did in Python.
It taught him how to dismantle high culture and societal norms, just using collage and these rapid-fire visual gags.
Exactly. This grounding in visual satire is so critical, but what I think often gets overlooked is his academic path. Despite this obvious creative bent, he graduated from Occidental College in 1962 with a Bachelor of Arts degree in political science.
That background is absolutely central, isn't it? explains so much.
It is the missing link. That political science degree gives incredible weight to his later cinematic satire. He wasn't just railing against authority because it was funny.
He understood it.
He understood the institutional structures, the paperwork trails, the legalistic jargon, and the pervasive systems of control that he would later translate into the fantastic visual hellscapes of films like Brazil.
He understands the system he's railing against.
Yeah.
It makes the satire so much more trenchant.
It's not just rebellion. It's informed rebellion.
So the real professional transition happened when he moved to England, starting around 1965.
Right. He began his career as an animator and a strip cartoonist, but he was already making connections across the Atlantic.
He was laying the groundwork.
Precisely. One of his early photographic strips for the U.S. magazine Help, which was a satirical publication edited by the famed Harvey Kurtzman, by the way.
The mad connection again.
The mad connection again. It featured none other than John Cleese.
Wow. So that connection was made early.
Very early. So when Help folded, Gilliam took the natural step and just moved to England, deepening his immersion in that burgeoning British comedy scene.
And once he's there, he works on the children's series Do Not Adjust Your Set.
Between 1968 and 69. And this is where the Python nucleus truly forms.
Because the show featured, who was it?
Three other future Pythons. Eric Idle, Terry Jones, and Michael Palin. He was surrounding himself with the people who were ready to fundamentally change comedy.
The whole gang was assembling.
And then everything clicks into place with Monty Python's Flying Circus starting in 1969.
Initially, though, he wasn't really in the group, was he?
Not in the same way. He wasn't one of the five acting writers. He was credited separately as the sole animator. His name was even listed separately in the closing credits.
Emphasizing his initial role as this purely visual resource.
But his style... It quickly became the indispensable glue.
What's fascinating here is that his cartoons didn't just punctuate the sketches. They were the essential and often extremely low-budget transition device that allowed Python to jump between wildly disparate sketch concepts.
Without relying on conventional narrative structure at all.
Exactly.
And this is where we really need to do the technical deep dive. The visual style is his signature collage animation technique. It mixes his own hand-drawn art.
Characterized by those soft gradients. Bizarre, almost grotesque, bulbous shapes.
Huge feet, floating organs.
With backgrounds and moving cutouts from antique photographs.
Specifically, photographs lifted almost exclusively from the Victorian era.
Can you elaborate on that? Why that particular choice of source material? Why was it so creatively effective?
Well, it was brilliant because it created the perfect Pythonic tension. The Victorian era represents stifling British formality, rigid societal rules, you know, severe seriousness.
So Gilliam takes this inherited visual order, these stiff portraits and formal engravings, and what does he do?
He literally chops them up, makes them dance absurdly, and then feeds them to these bizarre hand-drawn creatures. It is visual anarchy superimposed onto visual rigidity.
And crucially, that technique was born partly out of necessity, right? The original Python budget and production schedule were incredibly tight.
Oh, absolutely. The limitation of a low budget and tight deadlines forced his creative hand. Instead of drawing complex frame-by-frame animations, the technique of moving still objects, the cutouts allowed him to create movement and transition quickly and cheaply.
So those constraints ultimately produced his instantly recognizable aesthetic.
The movement of still objects, as it's been called. It defined the entire visual flow of the show.
He eventually became a full member of the troupe, of course, but he did considerably less acting than the others.
Well, the running joke was that he often played the parts others didn't want.
Usually because they required extensive makeup, uncomfortable costumes, or just plain physical discomfort.
He truly embraced the uncomfortable, which is fitting for a man who later directed Brazil. We have some classic memorable roles, often characterized by their discomfort or sheer absurdity.
I mean, who could forget Cardinal Fang of the Spanish Inquisition?
Whose arrival was always unexpected.
Or the perpetually confused, limited intelligence Gumby.
Often seen flower arranging or wearing odd clothing. That character was part of Python's satire on the condescending way 1970s television encouraged the man in the street to participate in cultural activities.
The activities they deemed beneath them. Right?
And then there was Kevin Garibaldi, the unbearable brat on the couch, shouting the iconic line, "I want more beans!"
In the most awful family in Britain, 1974 sketch. A classic.
And, of course, his most recurring physical comedy role, the knight in armor who would just walk on and end sketches by heading someone over the head with a plucked chicken.
Pure, beautiful, anarchic nonsense that perfectly complements the writing.
And beyond the screen, his role as the visual architect extended to print and audio. He designed the covers of most of the Monty Python albums.
Another Monty Python record, the Monty Python matching tie and handkerchief.
Monty Python Live at Drury Lane. He cemented his role as the group's visual core, even outside of television.
So it's important to see this era not just as his comedy apprenticeship.
No, it was his training ground in practical visual storytelling under immense pressure. He learned how to convey massive ideas like the absurdity of authority or the meaninglessness of logic using minimal resources and maximum imagination.
The transition from animating sketch transitions to directing feature films was, well, surprisingly quick. It started with the first Python movie that truly embraced that epic scale.
It really shows he was ready to take control of the entire frame.
We're talking about Monty Python and the Holy Grail in 1975.
That was his initial step as a director, but it was a deeply collaborative split with Terry Jones. Gilliam was responsible for the photography, for capturing that stunningly gritty, windswept, mud-splattered medieval aesthetic.
The look that made the film feel so real, despite the comedy.
Exactly. And Jones, meanwhile, guided the actors' performances.
And even while co-directing, he still stepped in front of the camera. He played Patsy, the long-suffering sidekick.
Get the coconuts.
Providing the famous coconut sound effects for King Arthur's non-existent horse and the old man from scene 24.
It was his only Python film as director, and it cemented the idea that he could handle the visual logistics of a feature.
So once Python started taking longer breaks, Gilliam branched out as a solo filmmaker armed with all that hard-won experience.
His first solo film, Jabberwocky, came out in 1977. It was also a comedy set in the Middle Ages, based on the Lewis Carroll poem.
And it starred Michael Palin.
He kept those familiar, chaotic faces close for his first outing.
But he was still firmly tied to Python. He served as art director on Monty Python's Life of Brian in 1979.
With Terry Jones taking on sole directing duties for that one. And crucially, in 1983, he directed that fantastic short film, The Crimson Permanent Assurance.
The swashbuckling pirate tale about office workers rebelling against corporate capitalism.
Which opened showings of Monty Python's The Meaning of Life.
That short film, The Crimson Permanent Assurance, it feels like a perfect thematic bridge, doesn't it? It shows the shift from pure comedy to his lifelong preoccupation with the struggle against corporate bureaucracy.
Absolutely. This transitional period gave way to a truly remarkable run of films organized by his own thematic structure, The Trilogy of Imagination.
Spanning 1981 to 1988, this trilogy is absolutely central to understanding him as an auteur. Gilliam wrote all three films, and they're centered on the ages of man and the struggle to escape an awkward, often stifling societal order through imagination.
And the core difference between the films is how that escape mechanism works. The running theme is the desire to escape ordered society through whatever means possible. But the nature of that imagination changes with age.
It reflects the shifting stakes.
Exactly.
So first up, we have Time Bandits in 1981. This views the struggle and the desire to escape through the eyes of a child, Kevin.
For the child, Kevin, the imagination is pure, untainted wonder. It's a desire for material gain and adventure.
He wants to escape his mundane, consumerist parents and just step into the maps of history.
Right. The bureaucracy he faces is small scale. His parents' dullness, the physical confines of his bedroom, the imagination is a literal portal.
But the film still teaches him that even in fantasy, the forces of pure evil and chaos exist.
Then the thematic centerpiece, Brazil, from 1985. This sees imagination battling authoritarianism through the eyes of a man in his 30s, Sam Lowry.
This is where that political science degree truly shines.
Oh, absolutely. Sam Lowry's imagination isn't pure escape. It's a desperately needed psychological defense mechanism against the overwhelming physical reality of the state.
He's trapped in a labyrinth of ductwork, misinformation, and mandatory paperwork.
So his fantasy of being a winged hero saving the damsel is his only way to retain sanity and individuality within this hyper-ordered yet crumbling totalitarian system.
The film just cemented his reputation as a visionary auteur. It earned him major recognition, including the Los Angeles Film Critics Association Award for Best Director and Best Screenplay.
It is the ultimate dystopian satire. It lays bare the crushing weight of bureaucracy and perfectly illustrates that system of control we mentioned earlier.
And finally, the trilogy concludes with The Adventures of Baron Munchausen in 1988. Here, imagination is filtered through the perspective of an elderly man.
Right. And here, the imagination is not just escape or defense, it's revitalization.
A way to deny the physical and cultural decay of old age and the loss of wonder in the world around him.
He is the last bastion of true, heroic, if, you know, completely untrue storytelling.
This film also marks an important career pivot because it was such an enormous production struggle.
It was a sign of things to come.
Gilliam cut ties with Arnon Milchan and 20th Century Fox in 1986 to direct this project independently, foreshadowing his later legendary struggles for complete creative control.
So after completing the Imagination trilogy, Gilliam shifted gears entirely in the 1990s. He turned his focus back across the Atlantic and dove into what became known as the Americana trilogy.
Running from 1991 to 1998, and this is a real departure.
It is. These films were explicitly set on North American soil. And while they were still surreal and explored deep psychological instability, they featured fewer overt fantastical plots than the previous trilogy.
They were grounded in contemporary American settings, yet they still featured Gilliam's signature visual density and paranoia.
The first film in this series, The Fisher King, from 1991, was highly recognized critically. It focuses on the psychological breakdown and mutual redemption of a shock jock and a delusional homeless man.
And Gilliam's direction of his actors really shone through here.
It resulted in an Academy Award win for Mercedes Rule for Best Supporting Actress and a nomination for Robin Williams for Best Actor.
That's a powerful validation of his ability to handle subtle, nuanced, dramatic performance alongside his grand visual artistry.
It demonstrates he's not just a visual stylist. He can direct complex human vulnerability.
Next was 12 Monkeys in 1995, a time travel science fiction film centered on pandemics and social breakdown.
A film that became eerily resonant decades later. This gave us another stellar performance, resulting in an Academy Award nomination.
This time for Brad Pitt, for Best Supporting Actor. He played the volatile Jeffrey Goines.
And Gilliam uses the genre of sci-fi to explore how society dismisses people who see the truth. They are deemed crazy, locked up, and ignored. It perfectly fits his anti-authoritarian bent.
And the trilogy concluded with the wild fever dream adaptation of Hunter S. Thompson's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas in 1998.
If you trace the path straight from his early Mad Magazine obsession with chaos and visual overload, this adaptation of Thompson's drug-fueled American nightmare feels like a natural culmination.
These three films really show a director who, while maintaining his thematic integrity, the search for truth, the fight against overwhelming odds, was capable of mastering everything from medieval comedy to psychological sci-fi to drug-fueled satire.
And before we close out this section, we have to mention his early technical work. In 1978, in the midst of his transitional years, he published a book called Animations of Mortality.
It was described as an illustrated, tongue-in-cheek, semi-autobiographical how-to guide to his animation techniques.
It's a fascinating insight into the technical mind behind the beautiful chaos. A man obsessed with process, even while seeking anarchy. So now we enter the phase of Gilliam's career that has become almost mythical.
Right. His name is synonymous not just with artistic vision, but with the epic struggle to realize that vision.
This phase is defined by production disaster, creative battles, and just astonishing resilience.
And no saga exemplifies this more than The Man Who Killed Don Quixote.
A project that became legendary for its failure long before it ever became notable for its success.
The first attempt began way back in 1999.
This was a hugely ambitious project, budgeted at $32.1 million, which at the time made it one of the highest budgeted films ever financed using only European money.
And the disaster struck almost immediately, during the very first week of shooting in Spain.
It wasn't one thing, it was a perfect storm, a literal cascade of calamities that perfectly mirrored the quixotic struggle he was trying to film.
So what happened specifically in that first week?
Well, first, the logistical nightmare. The location they had chosen for filming a valley near Madrid was almost immediately plagued by unexpected severe flooding.
So the flood severely damaged equipment, the main set.
And, crucially, it altered the landscape so drastically that they could no longer achieve shot continuity.
Then came the actor's crisis.
The lead actor playing Don Quixote, the French veteran Jean Rochefort, suffered a herniated disc while riding a horse. The injury was severe enough to require surgery.
And given the film's reliance on his performance, the entire production was immediately canceled.
The fallout was immense. It led to a massive $15 million insurance claim. But here's the crucial irony. The failure was so spectacular, so profoundly dramatic, that it yielded its own highly acclaimed documentary.
2002, Lost in La Mancha.
That documentary was produced from the footage shot by a second crew Gilliam had hired simply to document the making of the film.
The failure itself became a defining, successful piece of art. It's a perfect mirror of the central theme of Quixote. The beauty of a magnificent, necessary failure.
But the vision wouldn't die. Both Gilliam and his co-lead, Johnny Depp, remained interested in reviving the project.
But the legal battle with the insurance company, that was grueling. They withheld the rights to the screenplay for several years,
leaving the project in creative and legal limbo until around 2008.
And over the following decade, the project was postponed repeatedly. There were talks of recasting, with Michael Palin reportedly entering discussions.
And later, Robert Duvall was cast for a time. But it just kept slipping away. It almost became its own mythical curse, a project that existed only in the realm of endless pre-production.
But here's where the resilience pays off in a truly satisfying cinematic way.
After nearly two decades of failed starts and rights battles, filming finally began in March 2017.
This time starring Adam Driver and Jonathan Pryce.
And Gilliam announced the shooting was finally complete in June 2017.
And in this triumphant, almost surreal conclusion, the film premiered on May 19th, 2018, as the closing film of the Cannes Film Festival.
Receiving a standing ovation, it was the realization of a dream that had lasted almost 20 years, the ultimate testament to Gilliam's sheer tenacity.
But the struggle with Quixote wasn't his only fight against tragedy. A few years earlier, he navigated another production crisis with the Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
A completely different kind of disaster. This was a human tragedy.
Production on Parnassus began in December 2007, and its financing was critically linked to the involvement of Heath Ledger.
Then, in January 2008, Ledger died suddenly in New York City, suspending production indefinitely. Variety reported that Ledger's presence had been a key factor in securing the project's necessary funding.
It was a devastating blow, creatively, emotionally, financially.
But here's where the community really rallied. Gilliam and his team came up with an inspired, innovative solution that fit the narrative framework of the film itself.
The narrative device was brilliant.
Since Ledger's character crosses into this magical, transforming dream world,
Johnny Depp, Jude Law, and Colin Farrell all signed on to complete Ledger's role,
creatively allowing the character to transform into multiple incarnations when entering the Imaginarium.
This innovative solution allowed principal photography to be completed on schedule by April 2008. The film was a critical and commercial success,
grossing over $60 million worldwide and receiving two Academy Award nominations.
And in this incredible act of generosity that just underscores the respect the industry has for Gilliam,
Depp, Farrell, and Law donated their proceeds from the film directly to Ledger's daughter.
And the final credits dedicate the film to the memories of Ledger and William Vince. It's a real testament to Gilliam's ability to inspire loyalty and collaboration, even amidst the absolute worst circumstances.
And we have to take a moment here for the truly bizarre anecdotal detail that happened during Parnassus filming.
What's that?
Gilliam himself was accidentally hit by a bus while the film was in production and suffered a broken back.
Wait, stop. He was hit by a bus and broke his back during the production that was already halted by the death of the lead actor.
He was. The man literally breaks his back, a debilitating injury, and still navigates the financial and creative crisis, completing the film on schedule.
That is resilience defined. When we talk about his films being about the struggle against impossible odds, we realize his life mirrors that struggle entirely.
After these huge sagas, Gilliam continued to direct, though perhaps with fewer spectacular external dramas. In 2005, he released The Brothers Grimm in Tideland.
And in 2013, he gave us The Zero Theorem, starring Christoph Waltz, a return to that paranoid, bureaucratic sci-fi landscape,
which premiered at the 70th Venice International Film Festival. And beyond feature films, he also took on other projects that demonstrate his visual prowess applied to different mediums.
Like the iconic 2002 Nike Secret Tournament ads for the FIFA World Cup campaign.
Those are incredible. They had a fantastic premise. A secret three-on-three tournament between the world's best football players.
Ronaldo, Thierry Henry.
Inside a huge tanker ship, all set to a pumping remixed version of the Elvis Presley song, A Little Less Conversation.
It's classic Gilliam. Visual flair, claustrophobia, and spectacle applied perfectly to commercial advertising.
We should also note an unrealized project that speaks directly to his origins. the Animations of Mortality CD-ROM.
This was planned for 1996, right?
Tentatively, yes.
Mm-hmm.
The idea was to release his thousands of 1970s animation templates as license-free clip art for people to create their own Flash animations.
The idea of Gilliam's animation becoming open-source chaos is just perfect.
Unfortunately, it never materialized. It was likely because the software company, Interactive, was in the midst of downsizing and shifting its focus from CD-ROMs to the rapidly growing internet business market.
A perfect microcosm of technology changing faster than art could keep up, leaving a potential treasure trove of visual assets locked away.
He also served as creative advisor for the animated steampunk parody 1884 and was signed on to executive produce The White Circus in 2013. He remains a comprehensive creative force, even when not sitting in the director's chair. So, shifting away from his films, let's look at the man himself and the choices and statements that have shaped his public profile.
Starting with that very public decision in 2006 to choose a nationality.
The renunciation of his American citizenship. He had held dual American and British citizenship since 1968, so nearly four decades of that status.
But in January 2006, he formally gave up his U.S. status.
He cited a critical balance of political protest and, well, practical financial concern for the future of his family. Firstly, he explicitly described the action as a protest against the then-President George W. Bush.
And secondly, and perhaps more pragmatically, he indicated it was related to concerns about future tax liability for his wife and children.
Right, relating to the U.S. policy of taxing citizens worldwide, regardless of where they live.
And the consequence was significant. As a result of renouncing his citizenship, he was permitted to spend only 30 days each year in the United States over the next 10 years.
He famously noted this was less than any European.
In a familial echo that demonstrates the family's shift in allegiance, his daughter Holly followed suit and renounced her American citizenship in 2017.
On the personal front, he's been married since 1973 to British makeup artist Maggie Weston, who worked on many of his Python and subsequent films.
They have three children, Amy Rainbow, Holly Dubois, and Harry Thunder.
Amy Rainbow, Holly Dubois, and Harry Thunder. Those names feel perfectly in line with the director who built a career on flights of fancy.
Absolutely. It's clear that the Gilliam imagination extends to the family unit, as all three children have also worked on his films, making it a truly collaborative family enterprise.
They reside primarily in Highgate, London, but also maintain a home near the Umbria-Tuscany border in Italy, where he helped establish the annual Umbria Film Festival.
His commitment to his adopted European identity is clearly paramount now, both personally and professionally.
Now, we do have to address the complex and often polarizing topic of his public statements and recent professional conflicts.
And we must report these impartially, simply stating the facts from our sources regarding his viewpoints and the ensuing reactions, which have become a defining feature of his later career.
Let's start with his comments on the hashtag MeToo movement, which he controversially called a witch hunt.
He stated, and I'm quoting here, "There are many victims in Harvey's life, and I feel sympathy for them. But then Hollywood is full of very ambitious people who are adults and they make choices."
And this was met with considerable backlash for, you know, minimizing the power dynamic involved in such decisions.
He has also drawn significant attention for comments concerning identity and provocation.
Mm-hmm.
He has stated multiple times that he identifies as a black person, even referring to himself as a black lesbian in transition, or BLT.
This is extremely jarring, so the context he provided needs to be clearly laid out for you, the listener.
When he was asked about this, he offered a clarification, suggesting it was part of his effort to bring back context and nuance into discussion by deploying absurdity.
He explicitly referenced a famous Monty Python scene, Eric Idle's character Stan Loretta from Life of Brian, the man who says, "I want you to call me Loretta. I want to be a woman."
And he stated, "People now might take offense at that. And when offense becomes so easy, it takes the fun out of offending."
So he views these inflammatory modern statements as a continuation of Python's lifelong use of absurdity and shock to satirize shifting social attitudes.
But that perspective is clearly running up against modern norms of sensitivity. And that tension has led to tangible professional consequences.
In 2021, his production of the musical Into the Woods, which he co-directed with Leah Housman, was initially set to play at the Old Vic Theatre in London.
The production was canceled at the Old Vic and subsequently moved to the Theatre Royal, Bath.
Reportedly due to staff unrest over Gilliam's involvement.
And the source material suggests that the friction began when Gilliam was reportedly asked to apologize for his earlier hashtag MeToo comments, but then further offended staff by publicly recommending Dave Chappelle's Netflix special online to his followers.
A special that was also, at the time, facing controversy over its content.
Gillian responded publicly and vehemently to the cancellation. He stated that the old Vic was intimidated into canceling our production by a small group of closed-minded, humor-averse ideologues.
He viewed his crime as simply recommending a brilliant and provocative American comedian.
He has also expressed specific views on trans inclusivity and activism.
He expressed support for a UK ex-police officer who won a legal challenge regarding alleged transphobic tweets, stating, "I'm a phobe, I hate hate."
He also reportedly blamed the advocacy group Stonewall for organizations and politicians feeling pressured to prioritize trans inclusivity over concerns for women, saying, "Maybe common sense is rising again."
While his recent comments are clearly provocative and designed to challenge contemporary norms, a natural continuation of his political science and Python background.
It's important to note the contrast with his consistent involvement in charitable work.
Since 2009, he has served as a board member for Vidaire Escredere, a UK human rights charity.
Vidaire Escredere, meaning to see is to believe.
And they provide training and equipment to local activists to safely capture video evidence of human rights violations, verifying and distributing the footage to those who can create change.
So the man who rails against the absurdity of bureaucracy and censorship with his art is also dedicating time to fighting real-world authoritarianism with concrete visual evidence.
It's a compelling contrast, isn't it, between his role as an artist provocateur and a humanitarian advocate.
It shows that his core principle is still the fight against authoritarian control, whether that control comes from the state, tax systems, or modern ideological rigidities.
So moving into the 2020s, Gilliam hasn't slowed down.
Not at all. His production of Into the Woods, co-directed with Leah Housman, premiered at the Theatre Royal, Bath, in August 2022 to positive reviews.
Successfully overcoming the earlier drama.
And he recently announced what sounded like a spectacular return to feature film carnival at the end of Days in June 2024.
This was slated to star Johnny Depp as Satan and Jeff Bridges as God.
With production originally planned for April 2025. I mean, it sounds exactly like the high concept, ambitious, and slightly doomed film only Gilliam could make.
But here's the twist. And it underscores the unpredictable nature of his creative process and his sensitivity to the current cultural climate.
Just a month after the initial announcement, in July 2025,
Gilliam stated that if Carnival were ever to be made, it would require an extensive rewrite because, and I quote, it no longer fit with the current world.
The world, it seems, shifted faster than his script could keep up, rendering his satire potentially obsolete or irrelevant.
And now for the very latest update from October 2025, which gives us a profound look at his legacy planning.
He announced he has shifted his focus entirely away from the complex and now dated Carnival concept to resurrect a long dormant project he wrote 30 years ago for Paramount.
The Defective Detective.
This is a powerful statement about legacy and completion. He explicitly said, "I'd like to direct it before I die. It's called The Defective Detective, and it should be my last film."
After a lifetime defined by projects that nearly killed him, that were cursed, and that required Herculean efforts, he's choosing to end on a script that has waited patiently in the wings for three decades.
So to recap his distinction, Terry Gilliam is a director of serious, often tragicomic films, exploring the eternal battle between imagination and bureaucracy.
But fundamentally grounded in his start as a visual artist and a comedian.
He is the only American Python who had to fight his way into the British comedy world, and he has spent the last five decades fighting for his complete, uncompromised vision.
Often literally fighting the elements, the studios, or his own government. He is a filmmaker whose career is marked by the fight against external forces, whether it's Hollywood studios, natural disasters, or the sheer weight of time.
He completes what many would abandon, often yielding triumphs like Quixote and Parnassus from the jaws of production hell.
He is the embodiment of the idea that high art sometimes requires maximum struggle.
Which brings us to our final provocative thought for you, the learner. Consider the ongoing tension in his career. Given Gilliam's decades-long struggle with Don Quixote, a film that defined cinematic struggle and only found triumph after 20 years of agonizing setbacks, and this sudden decisive shift to prioritize The Defective Detective as his final, most direct work. What does this tell us about the relationship between chaos and creation?
Does Gilliam's greatest creative output emerge from the agonizing projects that required decades of struggle and external chaos, or from those visions that find a clear, swift path to realization at the end of his career?
Perhaps the ultimate battle is simply knowing which vision to commit to and when.